morning, everybody. Special good morning to Anna Krasnodemska.
Thank you.
She's going to give her maiden speech today, and it will also be her last speech to us. You have absolutely nothing to be nervous about. You're going to tell us about business combinations under common control. Please go ahead, Anna.
Before I turn over to Anna, I would like to start with a quick introduction of Agenda Paper 23,
sure.
And then Anna will discuss this detailed findings. It's been a while since the board last talked about business combinations under common control, so we thought we should start with a quick overview of the background of the project and also talk about the feedback we received in the agenda consultation, and then move on to our detailed findings. So just as a reminder, business combinations under common control are excluded from the scope of IFRS 3. In practice, entities account for business combinations under common control either using the acquisition method or using the predecessor values method. Under the acquisition method, acquired assets and liabilities are presented at fair value. The essence of predecessor method is that assets and liabilities are carried at their carrying amounts. They are not revalued as a result of business combinations under common control. There are also some detailed differences in how the predecessor method is applied in practice. And various interested parties, and notably regulators, expressed concerns about the diversity in practice and asked the ISB to provide guidance in this area. The ISB last talked about business combinations under common control in June 2014. And at that meeting, the ISB decided that the scope of the project should focus on business combinations under common control that are excluded from the scope of IFRS 3 and group restructurings. And the ISB also decided to give priority to considering transactions that involve third parties. Since that decision of the board, we performed a range of research and outreach activities. And in those activities, we sought to understand both how business combinations under common control tend to be accounted for in practice today, and also how they should be accounted for and why. Overall, we performed over 30 meetings with various interested parties from various jurisdictions, including users, preparers, standard setters, regulators, with particular focus on users of the financial statements. In our initial outreach, we focused on which method of accounting is applied in practice today and which method should be applied. And in our most recent outreach, we focused on how the predecessor method is applied in practice today and also how it should be applied. And Anna will discuss detailed findings in a minute. And just as a final note, a quick summary of the feedback we received in the agenda consultation. About half of the respondents to the agenda consultation commented on business combinations under common control, and most of them rated that project as of high or medium importance and urgency. Only a few respondents thought that the project was not important and was not urgent. And this feedback is consistent with the feedback we have received in the online survey, both from users who responded to this feedback and other interested parties. And just a final note about our next steps. So assuming that the project, if the project goes ahead based on the results of the agenda consultation, the staff plan to present to the board detailed analysis of advantages and disadvantages of various alternatives of accounting for business combinations under common control, provide staff recommendation and look at the remaining scope questions. And we also plan to ask the board whether the discussion paper should be the next due process document in this project. So before we move to discussion of the detailed findings, do you have any questions on what we've done overall or the next steps?
No. I'm now going to introduce the agenda paper 23A, which discusses the method of accounting for business combinations under common control. The feedback that we received from interested parties indicates that business combinations under common control are common across various jurisdictions, in particular those transactions undertaken in preparation for an IPO. However, acquisition method, in those situations, predecessor method is most frequently observed. However, acquisition method is also sometimes applied. Many interested parties other than users of the financial statements broadly supported using the predecessor method of accounting in accounting for business combinations under common control. Or using that method as the default method of accounting and also applying the acquisition method in particular cases. Users of financial statements express different views as to which method would result in most useful information and why. If we compare feedback we received to two scenarios that we typically discussed, that is a business combination in preparation for an IPO and a business combination that involves a non-controlling interest, we note that there was more support from all interested parties in applying the predecessor method of accounting in a business combination undertaken in preparation for an IPO. That scenario is illustrated in illustration 2B on page 6 of agenda paper 23A. Most interested parties, as I said, supported using the predecessor method in that scenario. A few interested parties also suggested using a so-called fresh start accounting method in that scenario, which means fair valuing all assets and liabilities that are being sold in an IPO. There was little support for fair valuing some but not all assets and liabilities that are being sold in an IPO, which would be the result of application of the acquisition method of accounting. Views were more mixed on the scenario which involves a non-controlling interest. That scenario is presented in illustration 2B on page 5 of agenda paper 23A. Some interested parties supported using the predecessor method in that scenario. Others supported using the acquisition method of accounting. In particular, many, although not all, users of the financial statements thought that the acquisition method would result in more useful information in that scenario. Some users stated that the information needs of a non-controlling interest is the same regardless of whether the business combination is under common control or not. Many interested parties, including users of the financial statements, asked the board to provide guidance on accounting on, for business combinations under common control. Some interested parties, notably standard setters, asked the board to develop a conceptual basis in accounting for business combinations under common control. That is this paper in summary. Do you have any questions or any comments on paper 23A?
Just an initial question about the reaction of securities regulators around the world who've been dealing with this and have promulgated guidance in this area in the past, how they've reacted thus far. Have you done any research with them? Can you expand on that? The U.S., Australia, Canada?
We had overall 3 meetings with regulators, and typically this were, well, in all the 3 cases, this were a group of regulators from different jurisdictions. We talked to IOSCA, we talked to ESMA, and we also talked to WCS. And I think what we've heard that in most cases they actually do see the predecessor method being applied in practice, and most regulators, if not all, probably most, supported using the predecessor method of accounting in business combinations under common control. There were a few voices who advocated fair values, but that was
That's consistent with my experience. Thanks,
Stephen.
So I'm looking at paragraph 15 and the example. And in particular, your statement in paragraph 16 and the second sentence where you say staff then raise the question of whether the accounting outcome should be the same regardless of whether the business common control occurs. And I agree with you. I think in the first situation, it's quite clear we're just selling our shareholding in A and nothing's really happening other than we're doing the IPO. In the second case, reorganizing the group first, getting to the same position, and then doing the IPO. Why on earth should the outcome be any different? I'm going to jump ahead, if I might, slightly, because in the next paper, you say don't restate comparatives. Well, that's sort of the preliminary conclusion, which seems kind of to contradict that second sentence in 16. If the economic outcome is the same, why should you get any difference in the accounting? But if you don't restate comparatives, well, you do get a very big difference in the accounting. So what's the sort of the underlying concept that we've got in this situation? Is it to try and get to the same accounting regardless of how the reorganization happened to get to the eventual outcome, or is it to try and report what's actually happened? And in the second case, what's happened is that B has become a subsidiary of A only fairly recently.
That's a very fair observation, Steve. And maybe just to highlight, our intention for this meeting was more to provide the summary of what we heard as opposed to debate, like which particular path the board should take. But I think it's a very fair observation. I also think that there are two level questions, if you will. I think the first level question is, okay, do we go with fair values or do we go with historic and carried amounts? And so the illustrations in the first paper that sort of try to look at that. Then once you decided, for example, that for all or some business combinations under common control, you go with historical values, then you have a whole new set of additional questions. Okay, how exactly we do it? And I think it's a very fair observation that if you don't restate comparatives in the scenarios on page 6, you will end up with sort of different outcome in scenario 2A and 2B, which would be the disadvantage of not restating comparatives. However, there are also advantages to not restating comparatives. So for example, you can have a situation where it's quite difficult to allocate income and expenses from prior period to this new entity. And also arguably you could say that if you are restating comparatives, you are essentially providing pro forma information as opposed to reflecting the actual historical sort of the actual history. But again, this is something that we will need to discuss and address in more details in further staff papers.
The NCI scenario that you presented was obviously to focus people on thinking about the outcomes of what would happen, and particularly to focus them on thinking about the effect on a particular group of shareholders, which is one group of users. Is it fair to then for us to then kind of extrapolate the findings, which is that in that scenario, people wanted an outcome that was exactly the same as acquisition accounting, to all other circumstances in which you're dealing with a non-IPO? And to put it slightly differently, you've got two different outcomes here. In the one case, IPO, it seems like that is a single point. Only for IPOs are people comfortable with one outcome. You've got another single point example, which is an NCI. But it seems to me like that example is actually meant to extend to any other transaction that is not an IPO. Is that fair?
I actually think that these transactions, this illustration pretty much capture a large proportion of various types of transactions. If you think about it, you either have non-controlling interest involved in the transaction or you don't, so it's quite binary. And then if you don't have non-controlling interest involved, then you can have two scenarios where it is sort of internal restructuring and there is no subsequent IPO, it's just moving things around. Or it's exactly the same, it's moving things around, but there is an IPO after.
So let me first give you an example then. If I have a restructuring in a group in which the acquiring entity has 100% held by its holding company, but it has significant listed debt.
That's a fair observation.
That seems to me analogous to the NCI example, and that then in turn means that what I should be thinking about in extrapolating the NCI is to any circumstance in which the acquiring entity has a user base or primary user base as we would define it in our standards.
As I said, I think consistent with the discussion with the board in June 2014, we looked first at those scenarios which involve third-party equity investors. Yep. However, when we talk to users, we also try to understand the perspective of the debt investors. And again, we will need to discuss it in more detail in future staff papers, but we did think about that. And I think it's fair to say that what we've heard so far is that debt investors are not so interested in fair value information, because generally they're not about valuation. What they're trying to assess is whether the company will repay its debt. So it sounded like they were more interested in historical.
So then I think you've answered my question in that I'm perhaps reading too much into the conclusion that users wanted to see a similar outcome to what they would have had if this wasn't under common control.
Again, that statement was not made by all the users. So some users said that specifically, but not everyone.
The other question is just, am I also correct in reading here that Fresh Start pretty much got no traction at all? There was very little interest in the Fresh Start approach.
Yes. And I think it's fair to say that with Fresh Start, if the respondents we talked to generally advocated the user's fair values, then that could be the driver for them advocating Fresh Start in an IPO scenario.
Is that the case even when there's a 100% change in ownership? So when you go from a situation where a holding company owns one or more parties directly or indirectly, and then they give it entirely to their shareholders?
Yeah, there's one scenario we have not yet, and I'm part of the board of advisors. We have not yet very much look into it. Is a spin-off of an entity which is an existing entity and say with four segments of business.
I'm not talking about a spin-off, I'm talking about a sale on an IPO.
Yeah, but in the case of Fresh Start, just to answer the question about the appetite for Fresh Start, we have not yet tested much the scenario where you break a company, an entity into four separate, or two or three separate listed entities, and where you have a difficulty to allocate existing amounts to those different businesses. Whether or not Fresh Start would be more helpful in that case has not yet been much studied yet, right?
Okay. Because I found that there are instances where it was applied, the Fresh Start. They call it next purchase price accounting. Mm. Next purchase price. Because IPO.
Amaru.
Thanks, Hans. I just would like to go back to Pat's question about regulators. Before that, I'd just like to express to the staff that you've been doing a great job in providing us feedback from a variety of stakeholders, and I think this is extremely helpful. And when you comment about feedback from regulators, of course, you comment on the regulators that we had the chance to discuss, with like IOSCO, ESMA, and the EECCS. And just to complement that, and going back again to Pat, I had the chance to discuss this briefly with the Brazilian Securities Regulator, not this paper, the paper you present to ASAF. And in Brazil, it's for the Securities Regulator, they are strongly supportive of the predecessor method. Mm-hmm. They basically don't see the benefits of having the acquisition method in the case of Brazil. Of course, this is not an official position, this is not written in any formal document, but this is the practice, and this is what they support. And I guess, although I didn't discuss this extensively in other jurisdictions in Latin America, but I guess considering the characteristics of the legal environment and the markets over there, I guess the predecessor method would be the most common practice all over Latin America.
Philippe? I would like to join Amaro in saying the papers are very clear, very good. But a comment about the statement of comparative that Steve raised. Under IFRS 3, normal business combinations, we don't restate comparatives, although it might be useful to investors to see what would have been the trend of operations mm-hmm. on a like-for-like basis. And some investors do like to see trend information, so they like to see a restatement of prior periods to do the calculations of trends on the same basis. So this is not unique to business combinations under common control. It's a more general issue about which information is useful in case of a business combination regarding the trend series. In case of the IPOs, the regulators often ask 3 years of financial statements to be included in the prospectus. And when there is a complex, a so-called complex history, hence the entity which is listed has had some restructuring in the prior years, they do quite often require pro forma information on a like-for-like basis, on a restated basis. Mm-hmm. But this is outside of the financial statement. So the question is, should we try throughout our standards reach the same information objectives at the ones which are required by market regulations or not, is a more general question for us, I think.
Mary?
Several points. First, to start off echoing the comments about how useful it is to have gone out and systematically collected information. I mean, my recollection of dealing with this issue in practice is every time you talk to somebody from another jurisdiction, the initial discussion from both sides would be, you do what? And it just, you know, there are lots and lots of variants in thinking about it. I think one concern I wanted to express in terms of if we go ahead with this project, figuring out the path forward is, I think it would be very tempting on the basis of this information to kind of pick the favorite and go ahead, as opposed to stepping back and saying, why and how does it relate to other things? So I think a next step, if we were to actively pursue this one, might be to go through the range of alternatives that have been identified. And, you know, a couple of people commented about Fresh Start and others. And I think I would, from what's in here, I'd, you know, like more thorough, thoughtful analysis from the staff. I think I'd look at it and say, it seems to come down to, should it be current value / fair value, or should it be carrying over some version of cost? Within fair value, we have a model for combination transactions. Is there any overwhelming reason why, if you thought fair value, we wouldn't say we've got that model, and rather than having another variant for the subclass of business combinations, we wouldn't go with that model if we thought it was, you know, that fair value measurement was the objective. And so not maybe get distracted if we haven't heard anything compelling about why this class of business combinations is different, that we would need a separate fair value model for them. And then when it comes, then it says, so it's down to IFRS 3, some kind of carryover basis, or an it depends answer. My instinct is that it depends is the next one I would maybe try to assess and either knock off or promote to the top of the list. Because of it depends, we have to spend time, you know, seeing if it's feasible to articulate what the different economic drivers are that, you know, that make it an it depends answer, as opposed to saying there's a range of views about why one is useful and another is not, and we have to pick one. I think one thing we might want to think about in that it, you know, it depends, or, you know, is I think some of the responses we got might have been people thinking more about separate financial statements than about group, and that, you know, you, I think, were focusing on, well, what if you have NCI and IPO, you know, public transactions, but those might have actually been perceived by people as proxies for reporting publicly versus separate financial statements, because if you're coming at this with more thinking about the separate financial statements and you're doing lots of group reorgs, I think the notion of having lots of application of IFRS 3 drives you to predecessor accounting. Now, and my reaction to that is our primary focus is on financial statements for capital markets, and so I think that's it's that what do the users need approach that I think I would focus on in terms of trying to figure out if it's an it depends, or if we're going to pick one, recognizing that there are people that have different preferences. And then when I get to the user information, that the feedback from users that you had in this paper, which again, you know, quite helpful, paragraph 23, the advocates for the use of predecessor, when I went through these, I think all but B and C were arguments I think I could also make about applying IFRS 3 for business combinations not under common control. You know, it disrupts trend information, et cetera. And so I want actually the kind of standard division that we see whenever we talk about a topic of some prefer this, some prefer that. It isn't, there weren't things in here that made me say these are specific to BizCom under common control. It seemed to be a range of views. So those are the things that I think I would think about in terms of how I would progress the project, because I'd be a little concerned if we just jumped to a development of the staff recommendation without trying to work through, you know, why this, why that. And, you know, may need to spend some more time, you know, thinking about Daryl's questions, looking at the example financial statements, about whether we may be getting some noise or skewing of this if people are thinking about financial statements for purposes other than external reporting.
Gary.
Thank you. And like some of the others, Julia, kind of very good papers. I really like the examples. I encourage you to keep using the same templates, and because I think we finally got them in our heads. A couple of thoughts. I'll try to stick to the content of the paper, suppose what I think the accounting should be, which, you know, I think anyways. Paragraph 21. I mean, I would probably, my takeaway from these papers is that user reviews are all over the place. They're inconclusive, and it's more than just some say and others say. There really is limited trend that you can grasp for us. I think as we start new projects, I think the user view should try to guide us, you know, towards where we should at least try to get to. But here, without any clear compass, I think we're left more on our own as to what we think the best answer is, as opposed to guided by input, because some, they're from extremes, all fair value to no fair value between. So that's just an observation. That's my takeaway out of these papers, is that they'll have views, but there's no prevailing view.
I think maybe just one comment, Gary. I think with users it's fair to say that in an IPO situation we had a prevailing view, which is the predecessor values method. It is in NCI situation where it was more mixed.
Yeah. And then there's other scenarios besides IPO and NCI and stuff. On the charts on page 6 is, I understand the IPO, but the after IPO, but on the left hand side, if P1 was selling itself in an IPO, the whole group, I think predecessor accounting would be what prevails, their current standard. So sort of begats the question, if you're IPOing a subset of P1, why would you necessarily get a different answer? And then lastly, on paragraph 25, just a sort of reaction, when they say a transaction involving privately held entities settling shares is likely to lack economic substance. So likely, to my way, is probably a little bit too strong. It may, but I think the people putting deals together, you might have a very different view in their definition of economic substance. Maybe it's a change the tax basis. Maybe it's to more easily facilitate a sale. So I think likely is too strong of a term. If that's the views of the word the users collectively use, that's fine. But if it's our paraphrasing of it, I think it's a little bit too strong. I think may. And likewise, I think will not necessarily have taken place on market terms. I think that's probably fair. It's a related party transaction, you know, everything prior selling it. You never assume it's on market terms. But it may be, you know, but it's never an assumption.
Jungwoo?
Thank you. Yeah, this is a very good summary of all issues on the PCUCC. But as other board members suggested, I would like to know maybe the preference of investors on this issue, which method is more, they look better. But once Peter suggested that there are many different types of investors around this, maybe some investors on the parents' interest, and some investor on the intermediary, the parents. So, yeah, there are a different style of investors. So we need to classify these different types of investors, and what do those investors like to have? on this kind of a transaction. And also the one more thing is, if you see paragraph 30, the overall, the users support fair value, the use of the fair value in the NCI scenario, more support for the use of the predecessor method in the case of the IPO. However, if you see the paragraph with the 29, 28, in the case of IPO, many users prefer their fair value. In the 29, some users don't have a predecessor, I guess. So based on these three paragraphs, it might not be easy to make this kind of conclusion. Maybe the opposite conclusion might be, looks correct, because many, some.
No, but paragraph 28 talks about so many users who commented thought that all assets and liabilities should be measured consistently. Mm. In other words, they were saying that you cannot, in an IPO, after you mix sort of the group in a different way, you cannot fair value some assets and liabilities, but not the others. You either do everything at historical values, or you do all at fair values, and most people actually supported historical values.
Oh, I see. One more thing is on this is IPO and NCI. Is it correct? We are inviting new NCIs if we make an IPO. So the issue of the example, the one is related on the information demands of existing NCI. However, if you make an IPO, then you are inviting new small investors. So it seems to me the information demands might be quite similar in these two cases. Is that right?
I think there are a couple of things here. So first of all, when you do an IPO, if you don't lose control, then you will have NCI. Yeah. If you lose control, mm-hmm. then it's not NCI, they're just sort of investors in the entity. But also it's important whether these new investors buy interest in this sort of new entity, or in the previous scenario where you already have an interest in the entity, and then after that, that entity acquires another entity. So I think the point in time in which they invest mm-hmm. is relevant to which information they might want to see.
Yes, there are many cases, but some cases might be over. I'm saying is sometimes the information demands between these two scenarios, NCI, IPO, might be quite similar. So that's what I'm saying. In the paragraph 30, you made a different. They are different, but it seems to me many times they quite in the same information demands. So that's what I'm suggesting you better examine their more details on these two cases.
Thank you. Quickly, I was struck by the paragraph 27, and it says in many jurisdictions, non-controlling shareholders would not necessarily be protected. But if you look at the example, for the shareholders of NCI, if you put yourself into the shoe of shareholders of NCI, if you invest the company, and you don't really care whether this is controlled by the controlling party or not. So then the position itself is the same. So I can't really understand why they should not be protected. They say it's a passive investment, but it doesn't really make sense. What is the point of this argument?
I think so. First of all, it's not sort of paragraph 27 is reporting what other people told us, right? Second of all, I think the main point is that in some jurisdictions there are laws and regulations that sort of set out how any such related party transactions should take place, and these regulations are there to make sure that any non-controlling shareholders are not disadvantaged by such a transaction. But then in some other jurisdictions there are no such laws that look after the interests of NCI.
No fairness opinion. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a fairness opinion on the transaction,
any value can be used, and maybe controlling shareholders can make a profit on the back of the non-controlling shareholders.
I wanted to, firstly, I found this really interesting, really helpful, so thank you for these papers, but I wanted to just sort of add to a little bit of what Mary was saying in terms of being guilty of what I told everybody else not to do yesterday, aren't I? Mm. If we do further analysis on this, what I would be interested in, and what I would be particularly interested in is understanding what we think is the most useful information and why. So I think this gives us good information in terms of what people have been doing and some initial preferences of users. And why I'm particularly interested in what's useful information and why is some of the user comments. And when I read paragraphs 23 and 24, it seemed to me that quite a bit of what was coming through was sort of almost anti-abuse in flavour, in terms of being nervous about the solidity of the numbers, if you like, because of the related party nature of some of these transactions. And obviously that's an important consideration for us, and it might have consequences for whether we think things are really fair values, or the difficulty of ascribing fair values to numbers if we were to move away from some of the predecessor concepts. But I think if we're doing it for those sorts of reasons, we sort of need to be doing it with our eyes open and being clear about some of those considerations, because and sort of thinking in the first instance, putting that aside, what's the best information, and sort of trying to balance it. So I'm interested in the sort of drivers of what the useful information is and why.
Mm-hmm. The comments to some extent relate to what Pat asked. You know, for China, you know, this is one of the important topics China always wants ISB to take. It's because, you know, before the reform, you know, the nearly all of the companies are owned by government. And up to now, still the major companies still controlled by the government. So a lot of the business combinations under common control. When David Tatsumi and others helped China to establish the converged standards, there are a few Chinese standards which are different from us. And China may add options or delete options. In this case, you know, Chinese standards have clear chapters, you know, for business combination under common control. And when they set the standards, and as I understand, David and others promised, you know, we will put into ISB's agenda to solve these problems as soon as possible. So this is a long, long project, not a new project.
That is as soon as possible.
Yes. Unfortunately, that we never put as a priority. But fortunately, I would feel China may not feel it is so important now.
Oh.
Not because the transaction not there, still there. But it's related to Pat's question. Before China set the converged standards, you know, there are gap difference between the accounting and Chinese gap and accounting which accepted by Hong Kong and the US regulators. And when the Chinese company went to United States and Hong Kong to get listing, and originally SEC not feel sure, you know, what animal is, you know. Sometimes SEC will accept such a practice. Sometimes for another company say, oh, not this one, no good. You should adjust to some extent. And as a result of that, Hong Kong standards allow different variations of method. And the other side, Chinese standards clearly say that you should do this way, and then create a gap difference. And in 2008, I think the negotiation I involved before I came here, Hong Kong and China reached agreement. That is, if anything related to the choice of accounting policy, you know, there's the both sides will not recognize, you know, means you should not, you know, use this method for the Chinese capital market users, and use another method in Hong Kong, and then reach agreements. And after, I just checked the the result, there's no new captive funds created. But before that, there is a historically accumulated captive funds before 2008, but the number is not big because after 10 years, they already amortized some of the funds, you know, gradually. So back to what you said, you know, both sides, the regulator agreed the same position for business combination and the common control.
Pat? I'll try to be very succinct. Many of the board members' comments here have highlighted a question. They hadn't, in my mind, formulated it exactly the same way, but they've highlighted it, the same issue, which is, what are the main drivers or criteria for deciding whether or not to use predecessor versus acquisition accounting? There are two issues I think that you need to wrestle to the ground in your analysis. My experience going back as a securities regulator, the determinant was, at the end of the day, when you have that parent company in A and B, and B is coming under A, the view was, all you're doing is taking B out of one pocket and you're putting it into the other pocket. There's been no change in control, hence use predecessor accounting. Okay, so change in control was the driving criterion from the perspective of the reporting entity, which is the parent, okay? Fine. One of the points that Mike Wells raised to me, which I thought was quite interesting, which I never really considered before, is what is the reporting entity? And in the conceptual framework, we say that the reported financial statements are prepared from the perspective, okay, of the entity as a whole. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean the controlling shareholders? Does it mean the controlling and the non-controlling shareholders? To Daryl's point, if you're going to represent the non-controlling shareholders here, they might want to know what this movement in assets has done to the value of the company. So there's a tension here, I think, between who the reporting entity is you're representing. Is it the financial statements as a whole, in which case you might argue there's been no change in control, hence use predecessor basis, or I have to represent the interests of the entity as a whole, and some of them, okay, are outsiders, and hence change in value is appropriate. So that's, to me, the tension, the issue that you have to resolve.
And this, just to this point, Pat, eventually this information for these outsiders could be captured in disclosure, not necessarily
right.
in the
that's
financial
right.
statement.
Martin?
I found really the arguments presented by users in paragraphs 22 and 23 very interesting. And I think at the next step, maybe we should look at that in more detail, because I think some of these arguments, I think, would all be also, I think, relevant for if you have a business combination not under common control. Because if people say, okay, it will distort brand information, I think that is also true if we have a business combination which is accounted under IFRS 3. Then people saying, okay, maybe the fair values are not so reliable because they are determined by management. The same is true for a business combination if it is not under common control, because the fair values not are determined by third parties, it is determined by the management. And that is really interesting. But the main argument is, okay, because people saying, okay, maybe the price negotiated is not a freely negotiated price and therefore it is different. But then the question which I have, what does it mean? Because if you do then the acquisition method, you still have to do the fair values, come up with the goodwill. Maybe the goodwill is not reliable. Is that a big problem, yes or no? And therefore, I think if we would decide on not using the acquisition method, what is really the main difference in that? Is that because the price is not a fair price, or what is really the main difference? Because I think the information needs, I don't see any different from if it is under control or not control. And if we go too far and buying into the arguments of the predecessor accounting method, maybe people will question, but aren't the same arguments also true for the IFRS 3 thing? And that is, I want to really to learn more and understand more what is really the main difference and why users especially think, okay, that what is the point really, what they, in which circumstances they prefer the predecessor method.
arguments, right? Philippe?
Just quickly to respond to Martin, I think Pat made the point that the information needs of different classes of users may be different. There are the users of the parent company financial statement, and there are the users of the sub or intermediate entity, the NCIs, which may have different needs because they don't have an interest in the parent, they have an interest in the subgroup, which may become the main group when there is an IPO. And then they will become the parent entity's investors if after the IPO. So maybe their information needs may be different.
Maybe, yeah.
So the question, we have sometimes conflicting needs, and we have to deal with one set of financial statements to serve two different groups of users who may have different needs. This is our difficulty here. So can we manage those two conflicting or different needs in the same set of financial data, or should we have some disclosures, as one suggested, to address the other needs?
This might be a reminder, or this might be a confirmation of whether I'm thinking about this correctly. We keep talking about the group under common control as a reporting entity, but in fact that's not a requirement of common control. You can have common control where you have one owner who doesn't produce consolidated accounts, two groups under them, and if there's a merger between those two groups, it would be considered common control. So we just we shouldn't be confusing reporting entity as though these are always companies within the same reporting entity.
And also maybe just a quick comment, mainly to Pat's comment. So when we were talking about sort of doing our outreach and thinking about reporting entity, we were actually thinking about the reporting entity that reports, not the parent, but the entity that issues the financial statement. So in our examples, for example, in NCI scenario, it would be the acquiring entity. But that's probably best to discuss in more detail in the future.
Yeah, I think in any of these discussions, it's probably very important to emphasize the point that Daryl just brought up, which from which perspective and which set of financial statements are you talking about? The P level?
No.
The A level?
No.
The B level?
Acquirer.
That, in my mind, is the critical issue.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to make a similar point, actually, but I wanted to remind you of a couple of things in the conceptual framework as well. So if you look at illustrations 1A and 1B, I think mostly in this discussion we're talking about the subgroup that's A and B. And there, the NCI, the 30% public, are clearly part of the primary users of the AB financial statements. The two things I wanted to remind you of in the conceptual framework ED, first of all, we said in the ED that we think at the top level, so the P1 level, we don't think the NCI are primary users at the P1 level because the information they need is really mainly at the AB level. And so the place where they're going to get their information is there. It's not going to be at any higher level. We also say in the in the existing framework, in fact, that we're thinking particularly of users who aren't able to demand information, so they're relying really mainly on financial statements for financial information. So in this scenario, that's mainly the NCI because P1 is able to get whatever information it needs because it's in control. Of course, the shareholders in P1 are a different story, but I think the shareholders in P1 aren't the capital providers to the AB group. They're sort of indirectly they are through P1. And I think we ought to be very careful in all these discussions to make sure we're very clear which level we're talking about and who the users are. And we need to remember it's not just equity investors, of course, it's also debt investors. It was interesting, I think, during the discussion thinking then about illustration 2 and the IPO case. So in the IPO case, before the IPO has actually happened, there aren't really any new external equity investors. There's just been a rearrangement among within the existing holdings for the equity investors. There may well, of course, be some debt capital providers, but there aren't any equity ones. And so maybe it's helpful to think about when we're providing the information. So when the transaction has occurred but before the IPO, nothing really has happened for any external equity capital providers at that point. So that might be a pointer towards saying, well, if nothing's changed, keep the predecessor. We'd obviously have to think about the implications for debt capital providers and which would make more sense for them. So I mean, in thinking conclusion, the overall message is we need to be absolutely clear through all these discussions which group or which level we're talking about. And I think when we do the outreach, we need to be absolutely clear about that as well, because I suspect people we talk to may not always be very clear about it either.
Yeah, Peter, just to say, is exactly what I want to say. You know, the first I should emphasize, you know, a general term called business combination and common control are not very simple. There are so many different scenarios, and we use the similar terms. But in some terms, in some cases, it is so obvious. For example, the case Peter just described, I don't think the major concern is fair value or not, or whether the price is trustable or not. It's because there are some kind of internal rearrangement because of a legal regulation, the requirement or regulatory requirements. And you can say they are actually a concerned company. There's no change simply because of some kind of requirement. And so therefore, you know, there's no need to use fair value. And I recall back, you remember, I think in 2008, Australian Senate Senators submit a request, and we saw, I think, within a few months. That is, before or after Christ, I forgot, the Australian regulator required the financial institutions to reorganize internally, assume group into securities branch or insurance branch and others, and nothing changed. So the Australia senator submit a request. We, the board, conclude we accept to using the, you know, polling. But actually, related to what Peter just raised, you know, I want to add another dimension. That is, whether we look at issues static or, you know, changing in the future. And actually, in the discussion we had in 2008, I raised similar questions. If you look at restructuring static, you can say no change. But quite often the case, after IPO, immediately we have fundraising and others, or maybe, you know, strategic partners will join in. Then they may look at issues differently. They may want to have fair value information. In conclusion, I want to say, you know, this is simple terms, but we may face different kind of transactions.
Okay, well, Anna, the board definitely has a problem bidding you farewell, because we are way over time, and you still have to do your second paper, but please go ahead.
Thank you. Okay, so I will now introduce paper 23B, which discusses the application of the predecessor method. So in terms of how the predecessor method is applied, we noted diversity in practice. In some cases, the carrying amounts of the transferred entities are used. In other cases, the carrying amounts at the level of common control are used. Likewise, in some cases, the financial statements are presented as if the entities have always been combined with restatement of prior period information. In other cases, the transaction is reported as if the entities are combined from the date of the transaction and the prior periods are not restated. The feedbacks that we received suggests that a restatement is a more common approach than no restatement. Any difference between consideration transferred and the net assets acquired in a business combination under common control are presented in equity, although practice differs in terms of the line items of equity presentation. Interested parties expressed different views as to how the predecessor method should be applied, which is consistent with the practice that we see. Some supported using carrying amounts of the transferred entity, some supported using carrying amounts at the level of common control. Some supported presenting entities as if they had always been combined with restatement. Some supported presenting combining entities from the date of the transaction with no restatement. Regulators supported combining from the date of the transaction and no restatement. Some interested parties did not express a view, and some parties, notably standard setters, asked the board to develop a conceptual basis for accounting for business combinations under common control, which they felt would determine both which method should be applied in accounting for these transactions and how this method should be applied. One aspect that nearly all interested parties agreed with is that the board should not prescribe where in equity any difference between the consideration transferred and net assets acquired in a business combination under common control should be recognised, and how to measure consideration transferred in the form of shares. The respondents noted that in many jurisdictions there are laws and regulations that prescribe those treatments, and so that is something that the board should not prescribe. As a final note, we have not discussed the detailed application questions in respect of the predecessor method of accounting with users of the financial statements. At this stage, our discussions focused on the whether updated values or historical carrying values would result in more useful information and why. That is the paper in summary. Do you have any questions or comments on the paper?
I only have a slight disagreement with the staff's preliminary views that were expressed in your outreach about the non-restatement of prior period information. The general issue I have is that we are told more and more that IFRS statements are lacking relevance, or no longer what people rely on to make decisions, and this is an issue we are facing, and we must try to combat this trend. In a business combination under common control, and maybe more generally in a business combination, and I always held a view about IFRS 3, another one, but I'm consistent with myself. Restating prior period on a pro forma basis is very useful. This is needed by investors, and they get it outside the IFRS financial statements. They get it from presentations by management to investors. They get it through prospectuses. They don't get it in IFRS financial statements. I think it's a big shame that people do not rely on IFRS data during the periods of the business combination. So I wonder whether it would be better not to take such a firm view that we should not restate prior period. I think to me it's an open question. How to do it is the next question, on the face of the main financial statements as a footnote disclosure to explain the effect on the business combinations. I don't have strong views, but I think to say it has to be outside the IFRS financial statements is in a way encouraging people to say, okay, I'm not going to use those statements because they don't tell me anything during that period.
Mary?
three reactions here. First, I think it's helpful to have the information that there's not a single predecessor basis. You know, if you did a headcount, how many use fair value, how many use predecessor, that within predecessor there's a range of issues. So that's useful data. I am a bit concerned that we're sending a false signal by saying, okay, here are the problems we're going to have to solve to make predecessor work, because it sounds like we've prejudged that we're going, you know, the focus of this project is going to be about tidying up predecessors so that it can be consistent. When I think the real focus of the project, at least to start, is should predecessor be used at all, or should we be using a different method? And I don't want this paper to leave a false suggestion about which one we're pursuing. And then the last thing, while I have a lot of, and it seems, and one thing that brought it to mind is the way we capture the feedback that said, people said we should do this, but we shouldn't touch that. You know, that sounds like they're already presuming, and I know it was in the context of the staff expecting a preference, but saying do this, but don't do that. Going back to that feedback about do this, but don't do that, I can understand why they said, if the board is pursuing predecessor, don't think you should go in terms of defining which category of equity a premium or discount would be reported in. But I have a fundamental problem with accepting, not challenging the notion that we shouldn't specify, you know, how shares should be measured, because there might be local regulation. Because I think the value of IFRS is, if you pick up a set of financial statements prepared in accordance with IFRS, you can have certain expectations rather than, you know, than, well, a local regulation determines measurement, and then we tell you how to account for what could be a wildly different measurement jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So I think there's a distinction to be made between, if we were to go this route, how would you measure the consideration, our job, and if, you know, if some of that has to be reported in different classes of equity, that's where I see a lot more validity to the argument about interaction with local regulation in terms of how you report, let's say, minimum capital, additional capital, etc.
Julia?
Just to respond to quickly to Mary's second and third comments. So first of all, with your second comment, just to be clear why we did sort of a separate paper and sort of a separate focus on the predecessor method. And that goes back to your comment on the first paper. So if we look at all the variety of accounting, we kind of know, okay, if we were to go fair value route, we have the acquisition method. And then we need to answer the question, okay, if we were to use to take fair value route, do it with the acquisition method or not, but at least we know what the method looked like. In contrast with the predecessor values method, we can't even fully discuss how useful it would be unless we fully understand.
Agree, absolutely. I just didn't want that focus to send false message.
Okay. That's what we intended. And with your last question, last comment also to be clear. So I think the feedback was not so much about measurement. The feedback was about presentation. And I think the feedback was, well, generally, the ISB, when it requires that something is recognized in equity, the ISB does not prescribe where in equity a particular item is recognized. So it's just consistent with the general ISB's approach. Interested parties were supported that presentation and equity should not be mandated. And there is just a little bit of a link to measurement, and that's why we specifically talked about consideration in the form of shares, because the mechanics of the predecessor method are such that essentially how you measure consideration in the form of shares in the consolidated financial statements only affects presentation and equity. And we've done some illustrative examples in the outreach that we performed, which we didn't bring here. But it was quite clear that it's just a presentation question.
If it just comes across in this paper as a measurement.
Okay, we will be very careful with drafting going forward, yeah.
Stephen?
You mentioned that some of the accounting standard setters had asked whether we could establish a conceptual basis for all of this.
Before.
I think that's possible. It seems to me that this is a bunch of rules. And there isn't really much conceptual basis, or perhaps there is possibly a conceptual basis for it.
Do you mean for predecessor accounting or for BC?
For predecessor accounting and deciding when predecessor accounting would be appropriate.
I think it goes back to the question which also was raised at this table today, as a question of, okay, why we even consider a different method for business combinations under common control in the first place, why it should not be the same as all other business combinations, or maybe it should be the same. And then, okay, if it's not the same, if most useful information would be something else, then why and what that information would be, and also should the answer be the same for all business combinations under common control, or are there different types? So I think it's more that flavor. But I think it could be quite difficult to articulate some elements of that.
I think we have to decide early on whether there is a conceptual basis or not, because if there isn't, then it just leads us down to picking a rule for each of the different components, which is fine, you know, maybe that's the only way that we can do it. One of the rules is therefore going to be restating or not, and I'm with Philippe, so I'm concerned about not restating it. It seems to me that if we are only going to recognize the assets of the entity that is being combined from the date of the transaction, which is what you're suggesting about not restating comparatives, and it's not just comparatives, it's also the period of the combination. If it happens halfway through the period, you only get those assets and the depreciation and the earnings from halfway through the period. It seems to me that if we're saying these assets have been purchased halfway through the period, well, if they're purchased, then surely it should be fair value that is the purchase price. So I struggle to to see why you shouldn't restate comparatives or assume the transaction occurred earlier than it sort of legally did, if you're going to not have fair values as the measurement basis, in other words, the cost of the assets on the date of the transaction.
Consistency.
Yeah.
Okay. I think this brings us to the end of this discussion. Anna, you're going back to Grant Thornton. Couldn't do without you for much longer, apparently. So we wish you luck and wish you success in your future career.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I prefer we are a bit behind, but I prefer we take a short break. Let's reconvene 25 to 11.